We started looking at the Ten Commandments, right? Basic principles, obviously. So let's try to continue that discussion. We looked last week at the first one. We looked first of all at an introduction to all ten, and asked why these are special, why there are ten. In fact, who was not here last week? Where were you? But we tried to lay down a theme in why these ten are fundamental. And if you remember, we said that it's not that they are somehow more philosophically fundamental, but that these are the ten categories. Right? The Torah always unfolds from a root. These are the ten root categories, if you like. And all other mitzvahs, all 613 mitzvahs, unfold from these ten, right? When Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses, brought down the Ten Commandments written on the tablets, on the Luchos, he wasn't bringing down a sample, he was really holding in his hands the whole Torah. If you hold a seed, you hold the whole tree, right? From that seed, the whole thing will grow. And therefore, really, he was holding in a compressed version, if you like, the whole Torah. And that's the secret of these ten, that they are really the irreducible root, if you like, in one way, of the rest of Torah. And we try to go further and say that, of course, the ten themselves are unfolding from a root, which is the first one. And we've been into great detail on that subject before. But the first of the Ten Commandments, Anecha Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem, that obviously is the root. Obviously, every other mitzvah also includes that one. Every time you fulfill any mitzvah, you're also fulfilling relating to the one who commands you to do that mitzvah. And any negative commandment, anytime you break a negative commandment, stealing, killing, adultery, immorality, any other negative that you break, breaking Shabbos, etc., you're also breaking the first one, obviously. Hashem commands you to do certain things, right? And then you go against those things, so you're offending your relationship with Hashem. If you're disloyal in a friendship, right, you are not only, you are breaking, insulting and breaking down your relationship with the person that you've chosen to be disloyal to. And therefore, obviously, pretty obviously, I hope, the first of the commandments really contains all else. When there's one who commands, so that everything else comes out of that relationship, and everything that's positive fulfills that relationship, and everything that's negative damages that relationship. Is this clear? When you buy your dear friend a birthday gift, right? So you're not only honoring the person's birthday, right, and celebrating that particular stage in his life, you're also building the friendship. Correct? No? Yes? No? Yes? When you bring 12 expensive red roses on Friday afternoon, right, especially when your wife's been upset with you for the past 10 years, and you spend a lot of money on them, you're not only preparing a sweet Shabbos, and you're also building the love between you, right? There's a general, you're not only acknowledging or fulfilling the detail, you're also, and everything really in a friendship or a love relationship is a fulfillment, and any disloyalty or pain isn't only a specific pain, but it's also a damage to the relationship in general. And therefore, you can't get any more general than relating to the one who gives you this relationship and commands you in the first place. Let's now study this evening the second of the commandments, which is the root of all negative commandments. The first of the Ten Commandments is I am Hashem, which isn't even phrased as a commandment. It's simply phrased as a statement. It's not you shall or you shall not. It is simply I am. The mitzvah that includes is the mitzvah of relating to Hashem as He is, which we call emunah, faith, and we discussed that last week. The second of the Ten Commandments is really a commandment not to be disloyal, right? Lo yelecha Elohim acherim. You shall have no other gods in place of me. In other words, not only must you relate to me, but it's not to relating to me and to someone else, right? That means is also a breakdown. Is it clear? Yes? No? And therefore, not only are you transgressing the act of disloyalty, that means you're doing that prohibition, which itself is a despicable thing, you're also harming, and therefore, obviously, the second is second and not first. As I tried to explain last week, that really the positive mitzvahs, which are all rooted in I am Hashem, are really the fundamental ones in terms of building the relationship. The negatives are really not building the relationship, but they are there to prevent breakdown. Right? That's why the first is called the fulfillment, the positive mitzvah. The second is a guarding or a... Perhaps the analogy would be that, if you if you build a factory to produce goods, then a certain amount of effort goes into producing the goods. Right? There's the machines, the production line, all that stuff. Then there's negative stuff, which unfortunately is necessary. You've got to have guards and a security fence and dogs patrolling. All that is not aiding production at all. In fact, you'd much rather not have to spend that money. That does not in any way help your production. Doesn't improve the quality of your product at all. It just stops it being broken down. Unfortunately, it's necessary. Yes? No? If you look at the modern economy, you'll see that an enormous expenditure today goes on things that really shouldn't be necessary at all. Go into any business around here, you'll see that probably as much as is spent on the business itself, they have to spend enormous amounts on stopping people stealing and cheating and damaging and breaking down. That's terrible, right? That's a symptom of a sick society. That stuff, that expense, is a great pity. It does not build anything. All it does is prevent damage. And therefore, as I try to explain, when you fulfill a negative command, you do not build anything. When you walk past the local jewelry store and resist the temptation to throw a brick through the window and run off down the street with the diamonds, you're not fulfilling, although you're fulfilling the mitzvah of thou shalt not steal, you're not constructing anything. It's true, the Gemara says, that if you're seriously tempted to do it and resist it, then you get the reward for a positive commandment also, because you're breaking your character. You're disciplining yourself. You're resisting the temptation. So that is a building of something. But that's only in as much as there's work to be done against your own resistance. Is this clear? And therefore, you can't claim a reward in a relationship for choosing not to be disloyal. Maybe if you're seriously tempted to be disloyal, somebody is very seductive towards you and resist the temptation, then I suppose you can claim reward. But simply fulfilling your loyalty in a relationship, you don't expect reward for not being disloyal. And therefore, all the negative mitzvahs in the Torah, right, are there not because they build your relationship directly, but because they protect what has been built. And therefore, although they are secondary, the punishments are worse. And I think that should be clear. The punishment for non-fulfillment of a positive is, unfortunately, you didn't build that yet. You didn't bring flowers. You didn't tell your friend how much you love them. So you've missed an opportunity to build a relationship. But it's not nearly as bad as damaging the relationship, as being disloyal or hurting their feelings. Right? That's much more... Is this clear? And therefore, the positive mitzvahs are the ones that are constructing. The negative are the ones that are protecting and not damaging what has been built. So let's look at the first of the negative commandments. Namely, there shall be no other gods. You should have... This is the prohibition of idolatry. This is a very strange thing to understand, right? We'll have to work very hard to get some handhold on this. Right? You shall have no other gods before me. What is the meaning of idolatry? This is extremely hard for us to understand for many reasons. One is that the subject itself is intrinsically very difficult. Try to explain that. But more important, perhaps, in a way for us, is that we live in a generation where we don't have that temptation. Right? We do not have a temptation to go and make images carved in stone and wood and bow down to them. Right? I mean, to us it seems absolutely ridiculous. One of the hardest things to understand about idolatry is why the Torah would prohibit something so silly. What sort of a person carves an image in stone and then says it made him? I mean, that doesn't sound like a religious problem. It sounds like a psychiatric problem. I mean, who would do that? Right? And the reason it's hard for us to understand is because we live in a generation where that's not a temptation. There was a time in human history where that was the preeminent human temptation. And I hope in this discussion we'll understand why that was so. So let's try to work through some of the questions about this very weird idea of serving idols, worshipping idols, making images, giving them, ascribing to them divine powers. Nothing could seem more primitive to us, and yet this is probably the ultimate human temptation. So let's try to study this. And in the course of the discussion, hopefully we can also pay a little attention to astrology and divination and various other soothsaying and fortune-telling type of things as well, because they relate to this discussion. Let's ask a few questions, first of all, about idolatry and see if we can target its essence. First question, probably, is why this is the root of all negative mitzvahs. You know, the Torah, as we said, unfolds from a root. If this is the first of the negative commandments, it means it contains all of them. Put it this way, every time I'm disloyal to Hashem, every time I show an allegiance elsewhere, So I'm breaking this one as well. Not only am I eating unkosher food, I'm insulting and breaking my relationship with him. He, after all, asked me not to eat that sort of food. He asked me to keep Shabbos. So when I break Shabbos, I'm not only doing that damage in the world, which damages a particular spiritual root and damages part of me. And when I eat unkosher food, it desensitizes me spiritually. And all the consequences that the Torah says. I'm also slapping in the face, as it were, the one who's asked me specifically not to do this. If a parent asks a child not to do a certain action, right, then the child goes and he does and he breaks that object. So he's damaged that object, right? The family's poorer now for that object that's broken. But he's also damaged his relationship with his parent. You can never escape that. And therefore, every negative command really offends this one, which is the root of all of them. So what we have to understand is this. Why is the root of all negative commandments, the most important one, the one that comes first in the Torah, the one that's parallel to serving Hashem and relating to Him, why is it something so weird? Worshipping the sun, the moon, the stars, the wind, graven images. I mean, had you asked me, I would have given you a list of 613 commandments, and the 614th, which would, thou shalt not be stupid. Don't be an idiot. You take a graven image, a tree, people worship trees. In December, when people have trees in their houses. Now, this is not a ridiculous custom. It comes from an ancient idolatrous prohibition. Right? They used to have a tree called an Asherah, right? Why trees? I don't know if there'll be time to understand this evening. But right, that is a pagan idolatrous symbol that's very specifically prohibited by the Torah. So that's the first question. Why is something seemingly so superficial and ridiculous? Why is it the Torah's major prohibition? Question number one. Question number two. More sophisticated way of putting the question. When the Torah prohibits idolatry, it uses names of false gods, other gods, that are very provocative. First of all, the Torah says don't worship other gods. Now, does that mean don't worship figments of your imagination? Or does it mean don't worship other gods? Again, there are only two options here. Either there are no other gods, and anybody who claims that there are is absolutely fantasizing and it's a complete figment of his imagination, and what he's worshiping is something that has no existence at all. But if that's true, why would the Torah say don't worship other gods? The Torah would be very misleading to say that. I don't know if the point is clear. If I say don't worship other gods, I'm implying there are other gods. If there are no other gods, I should say, don't fantasize. Don't be an idiot. Don't imagine that there are other gods and do actions that are related to them. But I'm very much misleading you if I say don't worship other gods if there are no other gods. The Torah has to be true in every way. So it's a very disturbing suggestion here that when the Torah says don't worship other gods, it's implying that there are other gods. Yes? No? Isn't that strange? And to put that question in a much more sophisticated way, whenever the Torah relates to these other gods, it uses names, amazingly, that are the same names as Hashem's names. When the Torah talks about idols, right, and it talks about other gods, it uses words that are the same words that we use for Hashem. Again, in Torah, in Judaism, in Torah, the words are essence. Right? Every word means what it says. So if the Torah wants to say, don't worship figments of, you know, ridiculous fantasies, it should use words that are words that denote non-reality. But it doesn't do that. For example, it says, Lo yelecha Elohim acherim. You shall have no other gods. Elohim acherim. That word is a word that means God. Am I getting through here? Why does the Torah use a word in describing a false god that's the same word that you use for Hashem? And all the names that the Torah uses for false gods are valid names of Hashem. Ki kol Elohei ha'amim elilim, for example, it says. Because all the gods of Elohei ha'amim, that is the name of Hashem, are little gods. Elil in Hebrew means little. Every time, yeah, in Hebrew, atzitz, elil, right? Words like that in Hebrew mean to make a small version of the thing. Okay, they're small gods, but it's certainly using a name that implies that they are there. The word Adoi, right, that word, is used for false gods as well. When the Torah denotes the gods you should not worship, it uses names that we use for Hashem. And surely if words are essence in Torah, the words the Torah should have used are words that are completely words that indicate imagination, not words that are the same words that attach to the highest level. It's true that the Torah never uses the name of Hashem himself, Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, the name we never pronounce. It's true. That word is never used except in Tumin Hashem. The word that never has a plural, Yud Kei Vav Kei has no plural, it has no secular meaning, it only means the essence of Hashem. The word Elo, that name, right? Elohim Acherim, that word, has a plural, which is very interesting, even though Hashem is one, and it has a secular meaning too, judges. The word Adoi, right? That word, that name, means Hashem, but it also is plural, even though Hashem is one, and it also has secular meaning. That it means master, or masters. So, but the name of Hashem, Yudke Vavke, the one we never pronounce, like the Jay's Witnesses, you know those people? That name, right, which is completely mispronounced, but that word, right, which is this English sort of a version of Yudke Vavke, that we never say it because it's not in the world. It is a name that's the root of reality. To say it would be misleading, you'd be bringing it into the world, and it's not. That is never attached to idolatry. That's always a name that stands alone. But all the other names, the names that bring Hashem into the world, what is the name Elohim? That name means the powers of nature, or rather Hashem's essence behind the powers of nature. Or the name Adnus, Adai, that name. That means Hashem as He controls, or is the root of the powers of nature, right? So it's bringing Hashem into the world, it's the expression of Hashem's essence in the world. Those names, which are valid names of Hashem, obviously, are also used for idolatry, very problematic. And there are many other questions. One of them is, why would people be attracted to such a thing? What could be sillier, right, than taking an image or a piece of wood and attributing some sort of divine power to that? And the attraction was enormous. Enormous. The Gemara says that before idolatry left the world, right, 2,350 years ago, approximately, when the men of the Great Assembly exorcised the attraction for idolatry. In fact, what they did was they ended the era of prophecy. And when human beings lost the ability to reach up into another world in prophecy, they also lost the desire to reach into another world in idolatry. You know, the easiest way to understand this probably is that the men of the Great Assembly lived in a generation where people were succumbing so readily to idolatry. The attraction of idol worship, worshipping the sun and the moon and the stars and nature, was so powerful that the men of the Great Assembly decided that it wasn't worth it. The reward for overcoming that temptation was not worth the risk, because people would succumb so easily. And they decided to change the human psyche. This is an amazing thing, of course. But they decided to take the human psyche, human, not just Jewish, and exorcise from the human mind the desire to worship idols. And the Gemara says they did it. The great Sanhedrin had the power to do this. And they called up the human desire for idolatry, which was incredibly powerful. And it came flaming out of the Holy of Holies like a shape of a lion, in a fiery shape. Interesting question. Why is the Yetzer, that means the incredible lust for worshipping idols, what's it doing in the Holy of Holies in the temple? I would expect it to be someplace way out, not in the center of reality, but that's where it was. And they brought this flaming image and they killed it. And from that moment on, human beings no longer have a natural desire to worship idolatry. That's why it's so hard for us to understand today. We don't have that very powerful lust and craving to worship these aspects of nature, and they killed it. But the consequence was that human beings lost prophecy. And the reason is something like this. Take a little while to explain, but something like this. The Gemara says that after they killed the desire for idolatry, they decided that they would go further. There's a general spiritual principle that when Hashem grants a wish, you should ask for more. You know that? If you pray for something, if you daven for something, and Hashem grants your wish, the halacha is you should say thank you, and without closing your mouth, ask for more. Huh? Definitely. Why not? If you ask for a tool that you want to use, and Hashem gives you the tool, He approves of its use, ask for more. Yeah? Definitely. And the simple way to understand this is what's called an Es Rotzon. Es Rotzon means it's a time of favor. Hashem has shown you favor in this area. You take advantage. In England, this is called finding yourself on a good wicket. That's what it's called in England, right? The Americans wouldn't understand that, but a good wicket means things are going well. So now that you've been granted your request in this area, say thank you. But as soon as you've said thank you, it says, open your mouth and I'll fill it. Ask for more. And therefore, when they saw that Hashem granted their wish, they asked for more. So they decided to take away a man's desire for women. They decided that if males would no longer crave women, the world would be a much more controllable place. Can you imagine what the world would look like? Imagine, for one thing, the advertising industry. Amazing. Can you imagine? Instead of selling potatoes by putting... I don't know what they put on a potato, but, you know...
whole world would look different.
So they decided to take away males craving for women. And they thought that would bring the world under control. And you know what happened? As soon as they did that, there were no fresh eggs. The chickens weren't laying eggs. Because when male is no longer attracted to female, and Rashi says, interesting, the chickens didn't even lay the eggs that were already inside them. Never mind the ones that hadn't been fertilized yet. Because the chicken's body heat dropped. They couldn't even incubate. That means this is a powerful drive that the passions that this inflames keep the world going in many ways. And therefore the sages realized that if there would not be a man's desire for women, the world would not continue. And therefore they needed to bring it back. So they tried to bring it back modified. The sages tried to bring back a man's desire for women, that a man should only crave his wife. Can you imagine what the world would look like then? They have no attraction to any woman besides his wife. And a little note fluttered down from the heavens saying, from heaven they don't give halves. No half measures. You either have it or you don't. You can't have attraction for this and not for that. It's either yes or no. In other words, basically the message is, when you take an organ out of the body, right, you lose all the functions of that organ. When you take an organ out of the mind, you lose all the functions. You can't take a human liver out of the body and expect half the functions of the liver to remain. You can't do that. When you take away the organ, that means this area of human desire, when you take it out, you can't expect some of it to remain. And therefore, they reluctantly had to put back into the human mind the desire of a man for a woman, but they managed to bring it back modified, the Talmud says. From that day on, they managed to bring it back blind, meaning from then on, men no longer crave naturally a relationship with their close relatives. From that time on, a man no longer has an intimate feeling for his mother or sister. Very interesting, before they wasn't like that. Right? At least that. Now, how they achieved that and what the mechanism is, we're not going to go into now. But from that time on, a person has an attraction for, a man will have attraction for women, but he will no longer have an attraction. Of course, you can develop any perversion. You can develop any sort of taste, right? You see people these days, they have fried ant bars. You know that? In Manhattan, you can walk into a fried ant bar. Peri peri ants? Ants? You can buy ants, grasshoppers, chocolate-covered worms. It's quite a business. Anyway, you can develop, of course, a taste for anything, but it's not a natural taste, right? Not a natural taste. That's what they did. What do you learn from this? That you can't have halves. So what happened was this. When they took away from the human mind the desire for idolatry, humans lost the ability to become prophets. Because the root of the human mind, that part of the human mind that longs to transcend and reach beyond itself, that is the same organ that longs to transcend and attach to something higher in the universe, like the stars, the sun, the powers of nature, but it's the same faculty that hears messages from another world. I would say, in a very simple analogy, that root of the human psyche is like a transceiver, transmitter receiver. That's sort of a radio. When you take it out, it can no longer transmit, but it can no longer receive. And therefore, humans no longer have the desire to transcend themselves and give themselves to something outside themselves that are higher, and humans no longer have the ability to hear something from another world. And therefore, the price they paid for losing the attraction to idolatry was that they lost the ability to hear prophecy from another world. And that left us in a situation where we no longer transcend beyond ourselves. It's easy to see what replaced this desire. What replaced the human desire for idolatry was simply a desire for myself, right? What you call ego. Previously, human beings had an incredible lust to dissolve their egos in a very specific way in bonding to something higher. In depth, of course, it's a real inflation of ego, and you have to see how that works. But now, of course, there's nothing to go beyond myself, and all I'm interested in is the source of my own existence, and of course you see readily that ties in with the philosophy of atheism. Previously, what was the attraction was idolatry, that means a god outside of myself. Now the attraction became atheism. There is no god, it's just me. And I mean nothing either, I'm just an accident. But that is the history of, and they did it because the attraction was so powerful. The Talmud puts it like this. The leader of the generation was Rav Ashi, great Talmudic sage, and one day he began a lecture about King Menashe. King Menashe was a great king of the Jewish people, who was an incredibly evil, idolatrous king. Very, very evil. He led the whole Jewish people astray. So when he began his lecture, he wanted to belittle Menashe. And so he began his lecture like this. He said, Niftach b'chavroi. Very hard to translate, but in common English you'd say, let's speak about our buddies. in a very belittling way of referring to this king. Why? Because there's a mitzvah to mock idolatry. Although mockery is a very negative human trait, when it comes to the mockery of truth, which is idolatry, it's a mitzvah to be mocking. So in order to break it down, he said, let's speak about our buddies. That night he had a dream. In his dream, the king Manasseh came to him and asked him a very interesting halachic question. I'm not going to go into now what it was, but he asked him a very interesting halachic question, and Rashi didn't know the answer. So Manasseh told him the solution to that halachic question. So he said to Manasseh, if you're such a great sage, you know halachic material that I don't know, how come you worship idols? And Manasseh said to him, had you lived in my generation, you would have picked up your cloak to run to worship idols. We at least managed to walk sedately. Yes, we were caught in the grip of this idolatrous desire, but at least we controlled ourselves. You would have run beyond control. And then he realized that the reason they committed these crimes was because they lived in a generation of such craving, such almost uncontrollable craving, that he would have succumbed had he lived in that generation. And the Talmud says the next day he began his lecture, Niftach Barav Ravoy. Let's talk about our teachers. Right? He now regarded the great King Manasseh, who was an idolater, as his teacher because he learned something halachic from him. So you see that we live in a generation where nothing could be more ridiculous. Who on earth would want to start howling at the moon or you know, bowing down to the stars? I mean, we don't understand that, but there was a generation when it was a tremendous human craving. What was the nature of that craving? Let's try to understand. The first thing to understand is this. People make a great error. They think that idolatry means that people think that nature, forces of nature, or graven images, idols, are God. Idolatry has got nothing to do with forgetting about God. All the great generations of human history, from the creation of man until the exorcising of prophecy and idolatry, no one ever forgot about God. Idolatry means that they worshipped intermediaries. Don't make a mistake. All the early idolaters knew about God. Of course they knew about God. They lived very close to the creation of the world. There were prophets around showing you who Hashem was. There were miracles constantly taking place. There were people around who were prophets who spoke to him. No. The Rambam says the early idolaters called God Elokai de Elohim, the God of all the gods. They didn't forget about him, but they weren't interested in him. The key to understanding idolatry is not that early generations of human history thought that there was no such thing as a God. That they thought that the lightning and the wind and the moon and the sun created the world. They didn't think that at all. But they thought that these intermediaries could be bought off. They thought that they had some independent power. Now, let's try to understand this. It's a fundamental principle. And it has many applications. And you can't begin to approach Torah with any sense of understanding without knowing this principle. We have to go here into a little bit of deeper background. Right? Even a little bit of Kabbalistic discussion. I'm sure you're all black belt Kabbalists. So I'm sure you'll be with me. But let's try to understand briefly. The world is built in this way. The world we live in is the last of many worlds. I know this is a little abstract, but bear with me, it's worth understanding. The world that we live in is the last of many worlds, the lowest, if you like, of many worlds. Are there worlds lower than this and outside of this? Yes, there are, but let's keep it simple. In a simple way, the lowest of the worlds is ours. Kabbalistically, it's called the world of Asiya. Asiya means the world of frozen, finite, fixed reality. What's unique about our world is that anything in our world is only one thing. Right? It cannot be more than one thing at a time. But there are worlds above ours. There's a world above this world called Yetzira, which is the world of formation. There's a world above that called the world of Bria, which is the coming into being of things. There's a world above that, which is the world of Hashem's name. And there are many stages of all these worlds. So the general teaching we have, and this is quite open, you can look it up in Nefesh HaChaim, which puts it very openly. If you conceive of Hashem as being the root, at an infinite distance from us, He brings into existence many worlds. Each one brings out the world beneath it. Each world has the unique characteristic of being creative. It is the source of the world beneath it. According to Kabbalistic tradition, it is male with respect to the female world that's beneath it. The two of them produce another world below them, which is the child, which is male with respect to the world beneath that. Each one is generative or creative. Each one brings out a world below it. That world then produces another one. Each one more tangible or closer to the physical reality than the world above it. Until finally you can get no lower, which is a world in which things are finally formed. They are not multiplex or plastic or dynamic, they are frozen. In this world, a thing can only have one set of measurements. In the higher world, in the world above this, things are swimming into focus. They're being formed. But in this world, the thing is formed. You can't get more fixed than this world, right? So far, so good. Each of these worlds has the characteristic that it's intermediary between the world above it and the world below it. It has something of the quality of the world that it receives from and something of the quality of the world that it gives to. That's common in all of these worlds. But there's one world that is unique. Of course, each one's unique in its own way. But for purpose of tonight's discussion, there's one world we need to focus on, and that's the world one layer above ours. What is the layer or the world one step above the world we live in? That is known as the world of the stars. Right? It's technically known as the Mazalot. The Mazalois are the zodiac, the level of the zodiac. What does that world do? It is able to receive from the worlds above, which with respect to us are infinite and endless, and project those worlds down into our world, which is finite. In other words, the world of the stars, what's unique about the Mazalois, the Mazalot, is that it's a world that has the ability to look up to an infinite source, but amazingly transduce that into a world that is finite. So if you could picture that world, I'll give you a very, very dangerous image. Very dangerous. As soon as I've said this, you should forget it. Because it's very dangerous to think in pictures. But if you were allowed to make a picture, which you're not allowed to, the picture would be something like this. Imagine looking up to a bath of water, a pool, enormous pool of water. The bottom of this pool has little holes in, and through those holes, streams of water are pouring. Right? Inside the water, all the water is one. There's no way of discerning any of that water. It's all one water. But as soon as it comes through the little pipelines, the little holes, they're separate, single, individual jets of water. That's what the world of the stars is. The world of the stars is able to look above to a world in which it's all one and bring down specific dispensation. When we say that the stars influence our world, what we mean is there's a world of oneness that splits up the dispensation, what's called the Shefa or the Hashpa, and brings down individual energies to specific objects, people, events, lives, phenomena, each one bringing down a source from the higher world. The source of all of these is actually one if you go high enough, but if you go low enough, you see, what's an astrologer? What's an astrologer? I'm talking about a real astrologer, not the back page of the Sunday Times, right? What's going to happen to you this month because you're superstitious enough to read the back page of the Sunday Times. I'm talking about real astrology, which is very hard to come by today. Is a person who knows how to look up to those jets of energy coming down and read them. This is not prophecy. Prophecy is reading the future. Astrology is not reading the future. It's reading the energies that are in progress now. Of course, with respect to you, he sees the future. But it's only because he knows the present more deeply than you. If you take a seed of a tree and you cut it open, a little acorn, and you show it to an expert, and he looks at this acorn, he tells you, if you plant this in 25 years, it's going to look, and he tells you exactly what the tree is going to look like. Does that man know the future? No, he just knows seeds. This is not prophecy. He just knows seeds. Is this clear? An astrologer is not a prophet. An astrologer can simply, and of course that's why he's not accurate. Because all he can see is the way the energies are coming down. But they could strike ground in very different ways. This is why, by the way, it's completely forbidden to go to an astrologer. Completely forbidden in Judaism. You know what the punishment is for going to astrology? The punishment is you find out what will happen and then you cannot change it. Why? Because when you put yourself into the system, you give it credence. Once you give it credibility, you become bound by it. The fundamental quality of a Jew is that we root ourselves beyond the Muslims. They dance to our tune if you live high enough. But if you dance to their tune, you in fact are bound by them. The Jerusalem Talmud says that for one who seeks divination, beautiful, very beautiful, the Talmud Yerushalmi says, when Bilam cursed the Jewish people, he saw these were a people who relate only to Hashem. They do not put themselves into the dispensation of the stars. And he said, Kilay nachash b'Yaakov. There is no divination among the Jewish people. Kilay nachash b'Yaakov. Yerushalmi says in Hebrew, the word loy can be read in two ways. Either it can mean there is no nichush in Yaakov, the Jewish people do not do these things, or kilay, for him there is. Meaning for the one who believes in it, for him there is such a thing. And then he gets locked in. And the punishment for... Yeah. I did not say you're not allowed to believe in astrology. I didn't say that. I said you're not allowed to go to one. There's a halachic concept that if an astrologer approaches you without your asking, you're walking down the street, and an expert astrologer walks in, walks up to you and taps you on the shoulder and says, I can see that what's going to happen to you is the following dispensation. You're allowed to believe it if he's an accredited astrologer. He's been right. Such a person you can believe, right? And you can take protective action. But you may not go for such advice because then you're giving credibility to the system. And the Talmud's full of examples like that. Example. Rabbi Akiva's daughter, right? So an astrologer told Rabbi Akiva that she would die on a wedding day. His daughter was going to die. He could see the energies coming down in such a way. And Rabbi Akiva took it very seriously. And in fact, what happened was the girl got married. And during the wedding meal, she was sitting at her own wedding. Yeah, she took a hairpin out of her hair and absentmindedly put it into the wall behind her and transfixed the cobra that was poised to strike and saved her life that way. So the sages gathered around and they tried to find out why should you merit such a miraculous... And it turned out that while she was enjoying her wedding meal, and the hall was full of people during the meal, a beggar had walked in asking for a meal. And no one noticed him. Rabbi Kiva's daughter, can you imagine the celebration? But she noticed and gave him her meal and saved her life. Meaning that when you live beyond the natural, that's not a natural thing to do. On the one day of your life when you can be a little wrapped up in yourself, if not your groom, you know, that's a day when you get married. To notice somebody else who needed... And if you live non-natural, you get dealt with non-natural. Right? Ein mazal Yisrael means that we're not bound by the mazal. The mazal's bound by us. Oh, you have to live like that, of course. You have to live like that. Yeah, the Gemara says like this. When Hashem spoke to Abraham, yeah, Avraham Avinu, he said to him, you're going to have a child. You'll have a child. He was barren. His wife was barren. They could not have children. They were 100 years old. She had no womb. So Hashem came to him in a personal prophetic vision and said, you'll have a child. So Avraham Avinu said to Hashem, well, thanks for the information, but the stars say otherwise. It's impossible. The stars say I cannot have a child. Who are you arguing with? Let's just get this clear. He's a great prophet, right? Hashem arrives. He sees in the stars he's not going to have a child. One day Hashem appears in person and says to him, you'll have a child. And he says, well, thanks for the information, but it's not... But the meaning is this, of course. When Hashem told him he was going to have a child, he knew that where the information came from. But who writes the stars? Hashem too. That's how he operates in the world. So what in fact he was saying was, he said, Hashem, you're telling me on the one hand I'll have a child, but you're telling me in your stars that I cannot. And Hashem said to him, you make a tragic mistake. You're not bound by those. The verse says, Vayetzo Isa Achutz, Hashem took him outside and showed him the stars. The simple translation is, he took him out of his tent and showed him the stars. The Kabbalistic translation is, he took him outside the stars. And he said to him, you're not bound by those. They dance to your tune. What does it mean? If you live beyond the stars, you live in a supernatural fashion, right? You're ready to do the kind of things he did. Then the stars dance to your tune. Nature obeys us, not we obey nature. That's what it means, Ein Mazal Yisrael. We are not bound by the stars, they're bound by us. But of course, you have to live like that. And the Talmud has many examples of such cases where people transcended their nature and... experience in fact, in the sixth chapter of the Yerushalmi of Shabbos, it has a whole list of these types of events where people were destined to experience a certain thing and changed it because of their behavior. But in each case, it was a person who transcended his own nature. So again, what do we have? We have a picture like this. There's a supernal source of oneness, comes down into this, let's call it this bath of water, and beneath it are channels of water, of light. Kabbalistically, they're called Sinoi Reis. Pipelines. That's what they're called. Pipelines. Each one is a specific pipeline that brings down an energy to a specific entity, and it is what governs that particular thing. How many stars are there? How many mazalas are there? 12. 12, yeah? 12? Why? Because in Torah, 12 is always one becoming many. What does 12 mean? It means one expanding fully. Now, take any three-dimensional structure, like this room. It's bound by 12 lines. Four lines there, four lines here, and the four lines that join them, right? The yud base, yeah, that's called the yud base kaveh alachson, the 12 meridia of reality. Any cube is bound by 12 lines. That fully specifies a three-dimensional structure. And therefore, there are 12 aspects to the reality of the world. The root of them all, the 13th, is one. In Hebrew, the word echad, which means one, adds up to 13. Echad, Aleph,
Chet and Dalet adds up to 13.
13 always means where many become one. 12 always means where the one has become many. That's why in Judaism, 13 is always a number of unity and always a very spiritual number. Bar Mitzvah, for example, right, is the integration of parts. So it's at age 13. The Jewish people are 13. They're 12 tribes coming out of the oneness of Yaakov Avinu, right? Of course, that's why 13 is such a favored spiritual number. And by the way, that's why in the non-Jewish world, it causes hysterical alarm. In the non-Jewish world, they're completely allergic to 13. You know that. You get the seat number 13, people start gibbering, you know, uncontrollably. It's like you can't. There's some streets don't have a house number 13. Some buildings don't have a 13th floor. It's like bad news, right? In Judaism, nothing could be better. And the reason is because Judaism is where the many become one. The non-Jewish world is where one becomes many. Yeah, the extent of power, the extent of the physical universe, right? That's the Esav of nature. He has much, and Yaakov has the oneness, the unification of many. By the way, which part of the body teaches this? Which part of the body? The body is always spiritually expressed. The hairs. The hairs. Inside the head, consciousness is one. Outside, you have tsinoiris. In Kabbalistic writings, the hairs are called pipelines. Each hair is a specific... The hairs are many. Each hair is one specific, finite, limited... In Hebrew, the words say are. See, in English, you can't... English is meaningless. Complete... But in Lashon Kodesh, in Hebrew, the word for a hair is a se'ar. That word is the same Hebrew word as shi'ur, which means a limited amount. Or sha'ar, a gateway, which allows only a certain amount through. Right? That's what the hairs are. The hairs are called din in Kabbalistic writing. They are the source of limitation. They're where things become specific and finite. This is why married women cover their hair, by the way. Right? Because the hairs are a very powerful revelation outside of a deep, personal, intimate oneness that's on the inside. And it shows very powerfully after marriage, right? And it glows on the outside. When the hair is covered, it damps that from the body. The hair is always aspects of the body that reveal very powerfully an inner creative energy. The body has hair growing on parts that are the roots of organs of Ashpo. Every part of the body that has an effect creatively in the world has hair growing at its root. Arms, for example. Has hair. Why do you have hair under your arms? Because a few million years ago when you were an orangutan, like you got, like the rest got rubbed off, you know? Like the arm is your organ of expression in the world. It's rooted in hair. Men, for example, are hairier than women. Why? Because maleness is an external production. Femaleness is a taking in and production within. Right? Esav, Esau, is hairy. Yaakov is smooth. Esav is in his hands, he's in the world. So he's a hairy person. Yaakov is smooth, he's in the inner world of spirit. Each hair is a specific numbered entity. Very interesting, the word for a number in Hebrew is mispar. Mispar is a number. The root of that word in Hebrew is sfar, means an edge. Sfar in Hebrew means a border, an edge. Right? A sipur, for example, is a story. It's made up of specific ideas. Sefer is a book. It's made up of individual words. Right? Sphira is the same root, actually. Very interesting. When you take the hair, which is limitation, and you cut it, the Hebrew word for haircut is tisporet. Amazing. The Hebrew word for cutting the hair is the same word that means numbering. When you apply din to the part of the body, that's called din, right? And that's why the Kabbalists put... That's why no Kabbalist in his right mind would have a haircut in the afternoon or the night. I mean, there's nothing worse than that. But be that as it may. So, the world above is one, and it comes down as multiple energies. What's idolatry? An idolater is somebody who looks up correctly to the source, but he doesn't go all the way. An idolater is not an idiot that thinks something he carved in wood is God. That's a real idiot. An idolater is somebody who carves a shape that represents a force of nature, which is a genuine source of projection of Hashem's power in the world. He's not a fool. He knows where the power comes from. He knows that the world is run by the wind and the moon and the stars and the sun. He knows that the forces of nature are Hashem's way of impinging on the world. You're not wrong about that. So he looks to these sources of individual powers in the world, but instead of penetrating them and going to their unitary source, he stops at each of these powers. Why? Because he's interested in who delivers the goods. I had a great teacher, Rav Simcha Wasserman, he put it like this. He said, idolatry is like a person who walks into a department store. Department store. He sees a camera behind the counter. It costs $1,500. He only has $150. So he calls over the fellow who runs the department and he says to him, I'll slip you $150, you slip me the camera. That's an idolater. What's he concerned about? Not who owns the business, not whose store it is, but who can deliver the goods. An idolater is interested in the God of love, the God of war, the God of fertility, the God of wealth. Who delivers the goods? Who runs the overall business? What's he got to do with me? Is this clear? And therefore, there's a God, the Greeks, think about the Greek gods. They had a God of love, a God of war, a God of fertility, a God of wealth. Do they have a God who created the world? He's irrelevant. What goods does he deliver? As long as you can pay off the departmental heads who deliver the goods, that's good enough. And therefore, idolaters weren't idiots. They knew about God, but they weren't interested in him. They were interested in paying off the individual departments. And that's not the Jewish way. The Jewish way is forget the departments, go straight to the head. The way a Jew handles these things is he walks into the department store and he goes to see the owner and tells me he wants it for $150. That's the right way to handle things. You deal with the one who has the genuine power. And what's wrong with idolatry is not that it's looking in the wrong direction. We're not talking about idiots. He looks to the correct source of energy in the world. The stars, the wind, the sun, the moon, these are what... But instead of penetrating them and going to the source that controls them, he imagines that they have some independence. And sacrificing a few children, or doing a few war dances in the rain, or that's what's so foolish about idolatry. They have no independent power. They are only transmitters from the source. And that's the ridiculous nature of idolatry, is ascribing reality where there is none. But it's not a person who looks in a false direction. And therefore, of course, you take it one step further, you realize that there's one step more. This person is interested in who can deliver the goods. What he's really interested in is himself. Which means that ultimately what idolatry really is for me. The difference is this. A person who serves Hashem says, Hashem, what can I do for you? Whatever you want, I do that for you. An idolater says, what can my God do for me? So what the real difference is, right, the Talmud puts it this way. It says that tzaddikim, Hashem stands over them. Righteous people, Hashem stands over them. Like it says, Hashem nitzav alav. Hashem was standing over him. Evil people, they stand over their God. Like it says, Paroi Omer Alayo, Pharaoh was standing over the Nile. Right? Yaakov is lying on the ground, there's a ladder, Hashem stands over him. Right? You sit, you are here, Hashem is there, Hashem, what can I do for you? An evil person stands over his God and commands his God to deliver the goods. Right? That's the ultimate turnaround. And therefore that is the right. I mean, you see it so clearly. Why is Christianity regarded as having an idolatrous element? Not Islam. Islam is another issue, right? Islam is not. That's a focus on the correct God. There's other issues there. But in Christianity, you may not go into a church. Why? Because there's an element of idolatry. Although they speak about God, they also speak about some intermediary. And what purpose does he serve? The focus of Judaism is, I serve Hashem. If necessary, I'll die for him. What's the focus of Christianity? If necessary, he dies for me. And therefore, that's the issue. The issue is who's here to serve whom, right? Who? Yeah. That is the concept. And therefore, the problem with idolatry is not that it's some ridiculous figment. By the way, it's noteworthy that almost all idols that are carved and shaped have a human form. Sometimes animals, but almost always there's a human element. The reason? It's a projection of the self. What's really being worshipped here is the self. The graven images are only a focus that's tangible for something very deep in the world, right? And therefore, they're not worshipping this piece of stone. They really have to be demented to do that. The image is something that you can keep with you, something you can focus on, something tangible. Of course, it's forbidden in its own right. But it's really a focus for something very deep and real in the world. But at the deepest of levels, it's completely unreal because it has no independent power. And therefore, that is the concept. Astrology is reading the forces that come down. Right? Illegitimate if you're doing it for the future. By the way, there's nothing wrong with astrology to read the present. An astrologer who has the wisdom of understanding personality, no problem with that. No problem. He can look at your eyes, look at your earlobe, look at your handwriting. If he knows how to do it, he can look at your stars. Right? I don't know why you need to go to a person like that. You should know yourself well enough to know that what your problems are without having somebody, you know, But if such a person has the wisdom and skill of knowing a certain birth time and a certain... Why not? He's not telling you about the future. He's telling you about you. He can know you. Why not? What you may not do is go to see the future, because that is a locking in, right, of an energy that comes down that in the Jewish reality is something that is not fixed. That's astrology. And idolatry is looking up to this, to that intermediary, and instead of going beyond to the source, Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, he deals with a departmental, with the departmental needs. And therefore, in summary, what we learned this evening is that worshipping idols is not some ridiculous, childish figment of the imagination. It is something dangerously real. The Torah posits it as the root of all negative commandments. We're talking about here an ultimate transposition. The ego is what's real. I am what's real, and the world serves me. And if necessary, I set up a God that can deliver the goods that I tell what to do. Yeah? And that's the exact opposite pole of the correct destruction of ego. Hashem, I'm here for you. Yeah? And of course, in negating myself, I become real. In the idolatrous system, Hashem is irrelevant. All that matters is where the goods are delivered, and that's how I bring it down to me. And therefore, the Torah is not yet talking about something ridiculous. It's talking about the most frightening and real of all prohibitions. And today we don't understand that. Today we understand very well the ego and the emptiness of existence beyond that. And we are all that counts, right? That's our reality. But in previous times, that expressed itself as the illegitimate desire to transcend and connect with something much higher, but not the ultimate. The ultimate is too high a price. What Hashem wants from me is the rest of my life, all that I am. And idolatry needs a payoff, right? Just a payoff, whatever I decide. And that, of course, was the ultimate motivation. And so the thing to take away from this discussion is that when you read in Torah sources about the idolatrous practices of early generations, we're not talking about fools and primitive. We're talking about a much more sophisticated world than we live in. They at least were transcending, and they had a tremendous craving to reach beyond themselves and to be something larger, something higher, connect with the powers of the universe, right? To have a cosmic feel. That was something tremendously appealing, rather than to be squeezed into your own limited dimensions. Today, of course, we reverse that completely. We squeeze our own limited dimensions, and we fool ourselves into thinking that that's all there is in the world, and the rest of the world is there to serve me, which in a very deep way is the ultimate idolatry. But we do it at a pathetically small and infantile level. And therefore, this is the ultimate prohibition in the Torah, and it's very hard for us to put our heads back into what that dimension was, but this is the beginning of approach to the subject. We'll stop there.